VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to a very special bonus episode of the Game Football Podcast. I'm Tom Clark and today I'm joined by former Kent, Middlesex and England cricketer Ed Smith. Now, as well as a long playing career in the game, Ed was also chief selector for England cricket between 2018 and 2021. But today Ed joins us to talk about football and his new book, Making Decisions, Putting the Human Back in the Machine. Ed, welcome to the Game Podcast. Now, the book is a really fascinating read. I really, really enjoyed it. And it's really interesting to me. You know, across the world, not just in sport, data is becoming such a big part of our lives, isn't it? I'm a digital journalist. I constantly told, look at the data, and I'm told, and I'm thinking, well, yeah, but no, this is actually a really interesting article. And so that is the genesis of the book, isn't it, in a way? The kind of,
if the conflict data was better, they'd capture how long you stayed. And of course they do now.
Exactly.
Dwell time.
Absolutely.
How long did you stay with the article, not just how many eyeballs?
Absolutely. Well, that's another great example. But your book talks about that clash, if you like, within the world of sport. But you make the case that we mere humans, we still have a role to play. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's a very, very good framing of it. The book starts with a question that a friend of mine, an investor, asked me. He said, how much longer, Ed, till the selection of England cricket teams is done entirely by an algorithm? Mm. And I didn't give a very good answer at dinner, and I sort of thought about it a bit more and it became a book. The answer is, I think human judgment has a long way still to go, and I explore some of the ways in which I believe that to be the case. Obviously, I came back into the sharp end of sport as selector 2018. It's a very exciting moment in the history of sports at the cusp of a data revolution. Mm. The amount and the richness of data is getting greater all the time. And we're able to capture information, analyze it far more quickly and efficiently than was the case when I was a player. However, it is not the case that that absolves decision makers from the need to weigh, reconcile, evaluate evidence, and then actually, crucially, to make a judgment about it. Which evidence is most relevant? How do you go about that process? There's no escape from judgment. I never once gave a press conference as a selector and said, the data says. Mm. I never said, the scouts say.
Yeah.
That's my job. Yeah. And it was my job to make those decisions. I think the human dimension is also interesting, not just in terms of, if you like, science versus judgment or intuition, but also in terms of the whole question of teams. You know, most sports revolve around teams, football, obviously, cricket. And also, so do most professions revolve around teams. Building better teams is a significant part of what every leader is trying to do across industries. And so in cricket, you've got this tension, which is also there in football, which is how do you weigh individual stats and evidence versus how it fits into the team? And when I think about teams I admire the most across the sporting spectrum, they are probably better at answering two questions. Not only is X better than Y in terms of our recruitment strategy, but also what are the team's needs? And that's a question that's often left out fatally, not only in punditry, but also in selection meetings or decision-making meetings. I always think a decision-making meeting begins with, I like X, not Y. Mm-hmm. The other person says, I like Y, not X. A good one starts with, what have we got coming up? What are our strategic priorities? What are our team's needs in these circumstances against these oppositions? And these opposition, and then the answer sort of drops out of that question.
Yeah, and particularly those kind of planning can't always happen in football, particularly, you know, this world where we crave success instantly. Do you find that both within your time as England selector, but also in researching the book, that thirst for instant success, did that sometimes conflict with the idea of building a bigger project, if you like, a better strategy?
Obviously, you want both. Mm. I sometimes think there are four possible scenarios: winning now and planning for winning in the future.
Yeah.
losing now and planning for winning in the future, winning now but not doing anything for the future, and then not winning now and not winning in the future. Yeah. And then you obviously...
That's the disaster.
You know, one is the best, two and three you could move between, and four is the disaster. Yeah. So I think there is, although I actually interpreted the role of selection maybe a little bit differently. I was very focused on, you know, let's get performance, you know, let's make decisions which will lead to the best possible performance now and in the future. It can be a bit convenient to always be rebuilding. Mm. One of the things I think many people in sport and football admired about Sir Alex Ferguson's teams is that he didn't really have rebuilding phases because he was always rebuilding. And that question, I think, in a team is how do you refresh a team without it needing to kind of completely fall apart or fade, and then you can sort of say, well, now we're building again. Well, actually, is there not a way where you can constantly renew? I think there is. And that's a fundamental challenge in selection, recruitment and team building, full stop.
Yeah. You mentioned teams that you've admired. Are there any particular ones? And I mean, we're going to come on to football specifics, but across sport, you mentioned Sir Alex Ferguson's Manchester United. Are there other great teams that you think have done that well, combined all those things?
I think there have been, and we'll talk about innovation in a moment as well. I think the time when you sit up and notice teams in other sports, most of all, is when you can really sense they're doing something new and different. Hmm. I think that was true with early Wenger teams. I'm an Arsenal fan, but also there was a great intellectual energy around those teams. And part of it was actually based on superior recruitment. He had an international global network, fantastic scouting, and also interest in data, nutrition, the whole picture, which was ahead of his time. And I think that was very, very interesting. I was actually just turning pro when Wenger was beginning his time as Arsenal manager, sort of, you know, 96, 97. I played my first professional cricket matches. So I watched that career with a lot of interest. And then, of course, you get a very recurrent problem for innovators, which is that other people copy and sometimes improve on what you're doing, which is another example of that is the Oakland Athletics, where Billy Beane was a pioneering GM, obviously the foundation of the Moneyball story, but then other richer teams, including, you know, his former colleague Theo Epstein and, you know, and the Red Sox, have more resources to employ those strategies, and that's sometimes the case. I think in the Premier League right now, yeah, I do admire what Brentford have done. Mm. And actually, you know, I have an institute called the Institute of Sports Humanities, and several of my students did extended pieces of work on Brentford's recruitment strategy. Really? And it was really interesting for me because they were kind of ahead of, they had more detail at that point than I did. Right. I spent a little bit of time with Rasmus Ankerson, who obviously was co-director of football at Brentford, and has the brilliant line, you got to look for talent that whispers, not talent that shouts.
Right.
And I think that's a very interesting question in recruitment across sport. And I think when I look at Brentford, you know, they have punched above their weight, no question. And they've done it through shrewd recruitment and through shrewd awareness of what they need to compete, rather than making emotional decisions based on, let's assign the most expensive player we can.
Yeah.
Set against that, you definitely see sports franchises in football and beyond where you see the pressure impacting on the decision. And, you know, often framed as, why won't they spend some money? And then they go and spend some money and it's in the wrong place.
Yeah.
Either the wrong player or the wrong role.
Yeah. Talking about Brentford then, that analogy of the whispering and the shouting, explain to us a little bit more about what you mean there. Is the shouting a big name, or is it an instant impact rather than someone of longevity?
Or someone whose skills are obvious.
Right.
So was it Del Bosque who had the great line about Busquets, wasn't it? If you only watch the game, you might miss him. Yeah. But if you watch him, you'll see the whole game. Yeah. I think he said it better than that, but that's the thrust of it. So sometimes when you watch sport, you miss a lot of value. Mm. And the art of selection and recruitment is to understand those players and those aspects of performance which are most easily missed.
Yeah.
You know, Daryl Morey, who's a pioneering GM in basketball, initially with the Houston Rockets, now with the Philadelphia 76ers, had the great line about the underrated Shane Battier. I call him Lego. Hmm. When he's on the court, all the pieces fit together.
Right.
Interestingly, the individual stats didn't capture what he was so good at. Hmm. But the team's plus minus went up a lot when he's on the court. And Morey's smart enough and data savvy enough to keep asking the question, how do we get five people on the court that adds up to more than the sum of the parts? And how do we recruit a roster that enables us to do that more than our rivals? Yes, that those kinds of ideas were prevalent in my thinking in writing the book and the way I thought about selection for England. So if you think about, if you ask the most unthinking, and there's nothing wrong with being an unthinking fan because some of us watch sport just for the hell of it and
absolutely,
the fun of it.
Yeah.
So it's not all about everything being turned into a highly analytical experience. However, if we ask the most unthinking fan who he'd like to pick, they'd probably say loads of really exciting players that score goals.
Yeah.
That's what I said when I was 10.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Why can't England just pick them all and line them all up and go out there and, you know, everyone will score, it'd be fantastic. A bit more to it than that. You're probably going to miss the player that provides the structure that enables creative players to thrive. And of course, if you're in the business of actually making decisions rather than just wanting to see everyone play a thrilling brand of sport, your job is to not miss those players and to make sure they're on the field.
Absolutely. And coming briefly back to the point you made about statistics and the basketball example there, do you think, and this is something I feel particularly within football, and perhaps it's a social media age thing of our need for instant information and slightly base level information, and it's something I talk about with statistics without context. So you can easily say, oh, look at this person's pass completion rate, aren't they
absolutely
superb? but what type of passes are they making? Is that something that you feel has gone too far in sport, i.e. we both in cricket in your time as a selector but also across sport, are we losing sight of that context, do you think, a little bit?
And that's a really good example, and I think that the Liverpool head of analysis made exactly that point. He said a while ago pass completion is a very flawed statistic because you can make a lot of very conservative passes and end up with a 90 plus pass completion, which hasn't actually enhanced your team's position. And they looked at goal probability added at Liverpool. I think that was the phrase or a version of that phrase. Well, in other words, how did the intervention made by the player impact on the likelihood of scoring a goal? Quite difficult to capture, but they felt they'd move significantly in that direction. And that makes absolute sense to me. You don't want to end up using metrics which are easy to capture and easy to measure, but which don't actually reflect real value. All the time, what you're looking for is to understand the question that yields an answer that helps you to unlock what makes the team win more.
Yeah.
That's usually a subtle and complicated question rather than an easy answer. He's better than him because his pass completion rate is higher. It's not like that.
And so, briefly, in a broader sense, before we drill down into more football specifics, what would you, is it a 50-50 split, the perfect balance between the kind of the data and the human side? I know I'm putting you on the spot.
No, I'm going to stop you because I don't think that's a, seeing it as a mixture, which you're basically saying, how much of one element, how much of the other, is it 50-50? I think that misses the fact that it's a compound effect.
Right.
So it becomes something wholly new and better if you can capture that balance and resolve it in a superior way. Let me give you an example, and I'm going to talk a tiny bit about cricket. England won the World Cup in 2019, and the super over was bowled by Jofra Archer. So the final was decided by England's fast bowler, Jofra Archer. It turned out that in the run-up to the World Cup, that was a decision that fell with us, the selectors. And at the very last minute, we added Jofra Archer to the squad. Quite a lot of noise around that. Is it too late? Blah, blah, blah. And unusually for the selection data team, we actually slipped into prediction mode at that meeting and said, not only do we believe Jofra Archer should be in the squad, we believe he should be in the final 11. Not only do we believe he should be in the final 11, we believe he'll be England's best seam bowler. He ended up getting 20 wickets, more than any England bowler in the history of the World Cup, and he decided the tournament with the super over. But if this sounds like a very scientific analysis, stop right there. All of that falls pretty flat without the human being, Owen Morgan, captain of England, the super over, there's 1.6 billion people watching on TV, and there's a guy who's played a handful of games for England on top of his mark about to determine the World Cup final. And Owen's available, he's open, he's relaxed, he transmits confidence, and is a masterclass in how to lead in extremely high-stress situation. No surprise to those who've seen Owen as a leader. So the point is that there are scientific strands to that decision, but they wouldn't have ended up being very useful without the human dimension too. And that runs through the whole book. You've not only got to try and work out where you stand on a continuum between certainty and, if you like, best guess, because there clearly is, the more and the better data you have, you push out towards certainty. The less good the data, the smaller the margin between players, you're moving much more towards a best guess. It helps to know roughly where you stand. But then also, where do the scientific strands interact with the human dimension? Because we're talking about teams. We're talking about intangible aspects, not just team spirit, which is often a pretty flawed concept, but actually how the parts interact. And that question of interaction, which I sort of sounds a little bit pretentious to say thinking in compounds rather than mixtures. Mm. But sometimes when you add two things together, you don't just get the sum, you get something completely different and better.
And well, you lead me perfectly onto my next question, which is about a section of the book which talks about tactical innovations in football. And you highlight Spain's success during 2008 to 2012 with their success at international level, largely playing without a striker. Obviously well documented within football in recent years. But what have you made in terms of Manchester City of late, Liverpool, both with Darwin Nunez and Erling Haaland? You know, they moved back towards a traditional, old-fashioned, as some people have said it, central striker, because that particularly with Manchester City, I feel, ticks one of your boxes earlier about refreshing and succeeding at the same time. They won the title last season and they've moved forward and they've refreshed and changed. Raheem Sterling has left, Erling Haaland has come in. You know, is that the kind of thing that you're... Because in the book, you also highlight the Spain tactical move as seen at the time as, what are they doing? What on earth are they doing? Which you have a lot of this summer, don't
right.
you?
So there's a couple of things. First of all, they did win the Premier League without Haaland last year,
yeah,
with
absolutely.
Slightly different structure. So
yeah.
Secondly, you know, that passage of the book, that came to me when I was flying out to a cricket tour and I read Zonal Marking by Michael Cox, which I think is a brilliant book, a very interesting mind, grappling with data and tactics in sport. One of the things that struck me, because I'm obviously in the middle of making decisions, some of which are controversial in a different sport, when I'm reading Cox, the thread of the book that I found most interesting is that every tactical innovation is extremely unpopular until it succeeds.
Yeah.
So there is innate conservatism in all sports. And of course, you know, pundits tend to talk about what they know and what they experienced. And this seems to cause difficulties in the short term everywhere. It's, when Spain move towards, whether it's the appropriate phrase, tiki-taka or fast passing, or lots of midfield players who aren't particularly physically dominant but are highly skilled. But that movement, if you like, initially people say, this is not Spanish, this is not who we are, this is not our football and culture. And then, of course, it's basically becomes adopted around the world. It becomes a dominant orthodoxy. The interesting thing, and I think this is where I remember also watching those games, was that right up to the end of that, I think the Spain were the most successful international football team in the history of international football in that period in terms of winningness, winning loads and loads of games. And they're often playing very similar players together, Iniesta and Xavi, for example. How often do we hear you can't play X and Y in the same team? Well, you can if you make it work. Right up to that, the third of those triumphs, you were still hearing quite a lot of people say, imagine how good Spain could be if they picked a big, strong lad to bang the goals in up front. Yeah. And you're like, well, 4-1 was it in the final against Italy? They're looking pretty good to me. So that conservative element, which exists in all sports, and of course, conservatives aren't always wrong. There are truths which tradition supplies. So it's not saying that you should throw conservatives. There's always a tension between innovation and, if you like, collective wisdom. But they're always ready to come back with the last laugh.
Yeah.
I would say actually that, Spain, and of course, embodied as well by Barcelona in that era, they did seem to me to be radicalizing an innovative approach to football.
Yeah.
Yes, in the case of Barcelona, benefiting from the world's best player, but not only that.
Yeah.
It seemed different and it seemed better.
Yeah.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Well, you've talked there a lot about innovation, and that leads on to the next section in the book, which I found particularly fascinating, both as a sports fan, but also as a journalist, because I've definitely been guilty of something that you highlight, which is pairing innovation and ingenuity together as similar things. Now, you say in the book that Johan Cruyff was an innovator and Jose Mourinho was ingenious. Yes. Can you explain to listeners what you mean by that?
Well, you've described it perfectly. And actually, I found myself making that mistake too, blurring those two qualities. Because I think we all do, because we like the idea of the smart person who's got the answers.
Yeah.
But there are many different types of intelligence and many different types of solution. That actually came to me, and it surprised me when I was writing it, because I was trying to work out why so many brilliant tacticians, who often, you know, end up talking about sport in the media, are often so anti-innovation. I was really struggling. I was, why do people who were brilliant captains say, oh, they're too clever by half, why are they doing this? They shouldn't be doing that. And then I realized, if you think of it as a card game, an ingenious decision maker has the same cards as everyone else, but plays them better. An innovator, it's a whole new game. An innovatus from the Latin, made new, something new. And actually, I think there's almost that sense of disappointment from the ingenious mind of saying, well, what do they need to do something new? You should be as clever as me and you just play the same cards in a better order and you win the hand. But actually, personally, although I have a great deal of respect for the Mourinho-type mind, the person who can change at halftime and have that in-the-moment intelligence to work out what needs to be done immediately, I suppose I'm more drawn and interested by people who radically change the game by thinking about it in a new way. We've discussed in baseball, obviously, Oakland Athletics did that through recruitment. Houston Rockets did that in basketball with shooting for three. It's a fundamental question. The question doesn't get any more fundamental than this. Why are people shooting for two when the benefit is shooting for three? Because they're not prepared to accept the negative metric. You're going to miss more when you shoot for three. But Daryl Morey points out, but in the trade-off, if you get the right recruitment strategy and the right tactical strategy, you win more. And actually, everyone ends up shooting for three more in basketball. So the whole game changes. In the same way, you know, I think Simon Cooper, you know, described, you know, Cruyff as the greatest genius because he both does it and then explains it. So first as a player and then as a manager. You know, that clearly is a revolution in football. And then, of course, it's radicalized and reinterpreted. And Guardiola's great metaphor about he didn't build the cathedral, but he refurbished and repainted it. And that he was building on Cruyff's ideas, which, of course, brings together that sense of evolution and tradition, which is very powerful. But in sport, we often hear from ingenious people. We often hear from them, and they think that innovators are overcomplicating things.
Right.
And of course, not all innovation works.
Yeah.
Many innovative people try one notch too far, or any, you know, in any set of good ideas, it's any set of, in any set of new ideas, a proportion of them aren't going to work. But sports at its most thrilling, I think, when it's a lab in which ideas are being tested. And of course, the great thing about sport and what makes it so exciting is it gives you the feedback, the wins and losses come.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you said you leaned slightly more towards the innovators, and you mentioned Arsene Wenger. I presume he's one of the ones that sticks in your mind most. Any other football coaches?
Well, that's a good question. I suppose, rather, I think there are clubs which have innovative approaches, and we've discussed Brentford. I think early Wenger was also a good example of innovation, because you could see, what was really interesting about that was that the blend of a very strong tradition, and I'm sure this has been put very well by people who lived it, and inheriting and building on existing strengths, defensively, culturally, a strong sense of club identity, but then also blending very new things to do with player recruitment, a global vision rather than just a kind of English vision. So he was English football's first great globalist, I think, which then, of course, becomes the norm. But back then, it was very exciting and very new.
Yeah. You also mentioned in the book, and this is perhaps quite interesting in coming back to cricket, is players that become either captains or coaches who perhaps aren't the superstars, if
very
you like.
Very interesting, yeah.
And we see that quite a lot, increasingly so, I think, in football. You know, Julian Nagelsmann by Munich was barely a player of any note whatsoever. And Graham Potter, of course, just got the Chelsea job, played in the lower leagues of England. Jurgen Klopp didn't have a particularly...
was not a remarkable player.
...glittering career. What is it, you think? Is there anything particularly about not being a star that then helps you perhaps be a thinker, a coach?
It's a very interesting question. I think a couple of things. I think football is ahead of cricket on that.
Right.
I think the tradition of someone who's an expert manager who wasn't a great player is longer established. I think we're probably getting there slowly in cricket. But, you know, if you look at the knee-jerk reaction is normally, can't we just have a really famous player as selector, a really famous player as captain, a really famous player as coach, and a really famous player as CEO, and then everything will be great. Well, it's not really like that, actually.
True.
And but in the case of your question asks very centrally, is there something useful about not being a great player? I think there can be. Obviously, Cruyff was a great player. Guardiola was a hell of a player. So it doesn't always work. I think being on the outside intellectually sharpens people's attention and their interest. Rasmus Ankersen also said a brilliant line that good ideas often come from just below the top level. People's appetite for risk is greater when they're not in possession. If you're the very best and you have the most resources, normally just carrying on as you are is a very tempting option.
Yeah.
Same is true, I think, for thinkers. If there's a marketplace for you to say predictable and normal things because you're a great player, everyone goes, well, you're a great player, well done, here you are, and you say something very predictable, that's what people do. The interesting thing is when people are trying to actually break into the top using better thinking. And I think there's an incentive issue there that players who tasted enough to know what it's like inside but want to leave their mark and they want to use their mind to grapple with better solutions, that obviously can help in terms of a managerial career. And yes, you know, if we look at the landscape in terms of managers today, a lot of them were played but maybe weren't defined by it. The other thing is, actually, again, another line from Wenger. Wenger did a great interview with L'Equipe once, which was fascinating, and he said, every time I'm introduced to someone as an ex-Arsenal player, it's a small tragedy. And what he was saying was they're still defined by themselves as players,
right,
but they're no longer players.
Right.
And can people actually force themselves to go again? Yeah, that's actually something I used to say to myself when I was selector. It's not about how old someone is. It's about whether they think their best days are ahead of them, either inside the game or in a different role.
Yeah.
And actually, I think those managers you cite there, the ones who played a bit but weren't completely satisfied, they forced themselves to go again. It's not a bad way to live more generally. Of course, there are a very small number of people who are just so driven that however much they succeed, it's never enough.
Absolutely. But it's very interesting that you mentioned, Ed, you must get you back on the Game podcast. You're teeing me up for my questions absolutely beautifully here. You say about that kind of level just below the very top, and that kind of leads me nicely on to ask about Gareth Southgate.
Yes.
England manager, of course. And the fascinating thing to me, speaking to someone from the world of cricket who's known both the playing side, international level, and the kind of coaching structures, is, you know, Gareth Southgate essentially embodies all the roles that lots of people fill in England cricket. Yeah. You know, at cricket level, you have captain, coach, selector. They're doing different things. They're offering different inputs. They're taking different responsibilities. As you said earlier with the Owen Morgan example, you'd helped promote Jofra Archer into the team, but without Morgan, the winning scenario doesn't happen. Yes, in football you have Harry Kane wearing the armband, but it's more of a figurehead role. Southgate is essentially embodying all those facets. Sure. You know, I wanted to ask you both what you thought about those two distinctions, but also what you thought about Southgate as a character.
Again, very interesting. So one of the things one of the points I make in the book is I'm agnostic about structure. There's lots of different ways of doing it. Different sports have different traditions. Football has a longer tradition of power being predominantly vested in the manager. Go back 100 years. You know, there have been many managers who've done an awful lot of decision-making within the club. Cricket is different, where actually the selector role is older than the coach role. The first England coach was 1987, Mickey Stewart, quite late in the day.
Yeah.
But there was a chairman of selectors, you know, 140 years ago. So the captain and the selector came first, and the coach actually came in from other sports. And of course, you should have a coach. Of course you should in cricket, and we always will from now on. There's another difference, which is there are three England cricket teams, not one. So if you're interested in analogy, you should also be interested in when analogy doesn't hold. England cricket's not England football.
Yeah.
There's one England football team and it doesn't play all that much in comparison with other sports teams. There are three England cricket teams, Test, 5 days, 1 day internationals, 1 day, T20, half a day. And they play nearly all the time. Mm. And balancing who's where when is a fundamental challenge for England cricket, and it isn't quite the same for the England football team. Where I think there has been some overlap, and I think there's been collaboration between England cricket and England football, is I think Gareth Southgate helped to create, as part of the FA system before he became England manager itself, you know, a strong sense of identity, belonging and culture, which I think he's then continued to develop and nurture in the top job, if you like. Mm. So I think there was a strong sense has been a strong sense in his tenure of a joined up you know, approach by the FA and throughout their pathway. And I think England cricket is the same. They have some very good joined up thinking there. One of the things I think he did very well in 2018 was he turned the relative lack of massive stars into a strength and an identity. And he realised that having lots of good players but relatively few global brands was actually one of the things that made the team attractive and engaging and could be turned to his advantage and the team's advantage. So I think there has been ingenuity there. And I think his teams have been very attractive. Obviously, there are always bumps in the road and frustrations and anxieties. Attractiveness is quite a subtle concept and more fundamental than people in sport sometimes acknowledge. It doesn't just mean playing attractive football. I think it also means the ability to connect and for people to want you to do well as a team. It's very powerful.
Yeah.
Sport is about belonging, about identity, about entertainment, about people giving up their time to share a journey. And they're much more likely to do that with warmth and an open heart if they feel that the people deserve it and enjoy it.
Yeah.
And I think Southgate's England have been a very attractive team in lots of senses.
Did you see parallels in that kind of belonging and the kind of national pride, if you like, in terms of the cricket teams during your time and what Southgate did? Because it felt like the World Cup win and those kind of runs in tournaments that the football team had, there were parallels in terms of the players being seen as very likeable and very accessible.
I think that's absolutely right. I remember watching 2008 football tournament with the England cricket team. And then, of course, it was England cricket's turn in 2019 and rugby as well that winter too. So lots of, you know, late stages tournament play, some of which, you know, England football obviously went to the final more recently. England cricket went to a final and won it. England rugby went to a final and lost out to a good team, South Africa. Yes. And actually, I'd say that one day team, Owen Morgan's team, was also a very attractive team, played with very expressive, very competitive, but also fair-minded. Mm. And I think, interestingly, there's always edge in elite sport, but I think the opposition respected that England team and actually felt they were part of some great games. And that's not to be underestimated. Winning takes many forms. We're all in the business in sport. You want to win desperately. I was probably sometimes too single-minded about that. But with a bit of perspective, you realise that actually the way the teams play is at least as important. I think we've seen that this summer. I'm not involved now, but just as someone who loves cricket, I've thrilled to Brendan McCullum, Rob Key and Ben Stokes as England. They have put a smile on our face. And everyone wants to play in that team. Everyone wants to watch that team.
They certainly do. They certainly do. Well, one team that people are becoming more and more attuned to is your beloved Arsenal, of course. And couldn't let you leave without asking you about them. Before asking you about Arsenal as a fan, I wanted to ask about Mikel Arteta, because some of the things we've touched on in terms of long-term building, people who think about the game differently, or perhaps just adapt what is there already. You know, how do you view him in light of the things that we've talked about as a coach and as a thinker?
Well, I watched a lot of Arteta as a player and I was very interested in him. I thought he was an outstanding decision maker. My book is called Making Decisions. He was a very good decision maker. And actually, you were very conscious in watching Mikel Arteta play of his intelligence. I would say he was one of the most intelligent players I've watched a lot of. And I also sensed at times he was a second manager. And I sometimes remember, you know, conversation with him, not just as a club captain, but it went a bit further than that. He was an extra shaping mind on the field. So you knew that was there. And then, of course, he went to Man City as assistant manager and formed that alliance with Pep Guardiola and then has come to Arsenal. And I think he's doing a very good job. I'll also say one thing about Arsenal, which is easy to miss. As I'm 45 now and I've had different positions in sport, inside and outside the high performance part, I've come over time to see the game more through the lens of, if you like, the top. And how that filters down. And when I say the top, what do I mean? I suppose I mean the decision makers at CEO and board level, and how that then supports and nurtures the decision makers closer to the pitch. I think sustained success is very difficult without there being clear strategy right at the top. And I think Vinay Venkatesham has done a very good job at Arsenal, appointing and then supporting and sticking with Mikel Arteta. And also just getting the club lined up right in a way that sustainable success becomes more likely. There's never a guarantee, but equally, it hasn't been a surprise. I think most people who follow it, the club, could sense that it was moving in a good direction, and you know, hopefully it will continue like it has done at the start of this season with some dazzling play on the field. But I think it's very hard to have sustained success without that clarity and that direction from the top.
I mean, Arteta for me last season was such a wonderful story, because he'd gone through quite a long period of being under pressure. We come back to that point at the start of the show about football's need for instant success, but you did feel like the Arsenal were trying to put that in place in terms of the long-term structure. Perhaps speaking now as a fan, finally, what do you think about into this season? They've had a great start. I feel like they've recruited very much in the mould of what we were talking about. Clever recruitment. Alexander Zinchenko has got to be one of the smartest signings for me in the Premier League this season. But perhaps putting your fan hat on, how do you view this season?
I see top four, actually. My friends at the club probably won't help me, won't thank me for saying that, but I do. And actually, much more than that, because actually prediction is probably less interesting than general direction of travel, because you can always be wrong about a particular season. But I think generally, I think the club is moving in a very good direction. And exactly as you say, and you see signals and signs of that externally through recruitment strategy, through the clarity of their approach. And then you can also sense, you know, inside the stadium, people kind of know that as well. And it becomes a virtuous circle where, you know, fans believe that emboldens decision makers that their message is getting across.
That they're getting the right way.
Yeah, and I would say that it's been a lot of hard work, and I think the upside is coming down the road.
Excellent. Well, we have a little trick at the end of the season. We always play back our predictions. So we'll factor yours in and we'll give you a little shout out. When Arsenal have got top four, we'll make sure we give you an extra little plug. It was absolutely fascinating chat, Ed. Thank you very much. It's a fascinating book. Making Decisions is out now. Ed Smith, thank you for joining us on The Game.
A real pleasure. Thank you.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.